one world champion crowned in Magny Cor as another rises from the ashes at Assen. Welcome to episode 33 of Bike Life. Let's go! Yes, it's one. Welcome to episode 33 of Bike Live here on Motorsport 101. Looking back on a historic weekend of superbikes last weekend at Magny Cor and at Assen, we will look back on Jonathan Rea's coronation at Magny Cor as he became the first rider ever to win three consecutive World Superbike titles out in France last weekend, and he did it in style as well. We'll look back on all the action as it turned out, even though he won the title, to be something of a mixed weekend for Jonny Rea, as his bad luck struck immediately after winning the title in race two. Bad luck doesn't go even near to covering it for World Super Sport, as Keenan Sofoglu's injury jinx struck again, leaving Lucas Mahias with a clear run to the title. We'll also talk about the World Supersport 300 class as Marc Garcia sets up a winner-takes-all finale with Alfonso Coppola at Jerez in 2 weeks' time. And we will talk about all of the showdown action from Assen in BSB as a non-showdown contender returned to winning ways for the first time since World Superbike's heyday back in 2014. I know Dre's dying to tell you about that one. We'll also cover all the big news of the week as Christian Eden confirms his spot on the BSB grid for next season, and Jules Clozel joins the greatest name of team any of us have ever seen in the World Supersport field next year. It's an absolute doozy. Don't worry about that. We'll also tell you about the big news at Ducati as Ernesto Marinelli leaves the team, and the injury news which could rule the home favourite out of the Australian Grand Prix later this month. For all of that, though, let's introduce Andre Harrison, who's particularly chipper after this week's Superbike action. Welcome, Dre.
I was just more happy about United winning. Oh, no. Oh, wait. What, something else happened this weekend? But yeah, some guy came and, you know, actually won on that Suzuki. Still with Ginters, damn it.
He's still with Ginters. And, yeah, he's finally had his reward for that year of suffering. As Sylvain took the victory. Well, also, incidentally, given that this has been a slightly delayed week of podcasting here on Motorsport 101, we're actually recording this on the Saturday lunchtime, Saturday afternoon, after qualifying has taken place at Suzuka. Yeah, Dre, you're doing well, Dre, I have to say, to keep that smile on your face, given that Sebastian Vettel and Ferrari were curb stomped by the Mercs in qualifying earlier today.
I told you before, like, Ferrari are the Atlanta Falcons of Formula One. Why bother rooting for them when you can just wait for them not to show up?
Yeah, they look so good on Friday as well. Incidentally, though, we'll talk about episode 107 at the end of the show in terms of what's to come, because we've given you a bit of an indication, given that Formula One is at Suzuka this weekend. But also, Dre, episode 106, as you listen to this on Bike Live, episode 106 will be online and available to listen to. Tell the listeners, the loyal listeners, what they can hear on episode 106. Sepang Formula One, top of the agenda.
Yeah, that was a mixed bag, to say the least. Yeah, we'll be talking about all of what happened at Sepang in Formula One, as well as an extended edition of the mailbag, some of the news, a lot of hype towards the Petit Le Mans at Road Atlanta, which is going to start in a few hours' time, and surprise, surprise, everybody, Penske on top of a timesheet. You're all shocked. So all that, inevitably, and a lot more, obviously, in the big driver shake-up news as well, coming from Formula One. Surprise, surprise, Jolyon Palmer's taking his ball and going home early. So more of that, and inevitably more, on episode 106. That'll be out by the time you're listening to this. Yeah, all that fun stuff, and me venting my displeasure at Lance Stroll. You know, that and alone is going to be worth listening to for, surely, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost if Sky listened to our podcast and thought, you know what, we're going to release some extra footage here as a right of reply. we're now going to release Strolls on board to try and counter this. Incidentally, though, you can listen to that by heading to all the usual places, including iTunes and SoundCloud. Our website is motorsport101.net, and if you want to follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/motorsport101. On Twitter, we are at motorsport_101. On YouTube, if you want to find show highlights and weekly video blogs and all that good stuff, youtube.com/motorsport101. And if you like us so much that you want to earn yourself early access to both this show and to Motorsport 101 by backing us financially, head to patreon.com/motorsport101. Let's head then to Magny Cor first and talk World Superbikes, and the coronation that we all expected last weekend at Magny-Cours to Jonathan Rea, who became the first rider ever to win three consecutive World Superbike titles. And I think what was nice about this, Dre, I mean, Jonathan Rea's been brilliant all year, as he has been for the last 3 years, was the way he clinched this. I mean, we've seen him in the previous couple of years. I know Johnny Rea wanted to clinch it in style after winning it with a fourth in 2015 and then winning it with a distant second to Chaz Davis in Qatar in race one last year. I know Jonathan Rea desperately wanted to win this title in style, and I think it's fair to say he succeeded in that mission.
Beat him down! Yeah, no surprises there. Well, actually, to be fair, that was a hefty mullering of the field.
Even by his standards, it was an absolute paggering.
Yeah, pole by 1.2 seconds and then wins the race itself by 16. It was a wet race, so obviously probably not the greatest barometer of how much of a pace advantage Jonathan Rea had, but destruction is probably the best way I can describe that. That was a devastating performance. By his standards, to just completely destroy the field like that. And as you say, winning in style the last year, he was pretty tame in her F last year, but this time around, just completely curb stomped the field in race one, and just effortless victory from Jonathan Rea to seal his third title. Just outstanding stuff.
Yeah, all we needed was the Mortal Kombat voice of flawless victory at the end as Jonathan Rea crossed the line, because he was just miles better than everyone else. Yeah, qualifying was good enough in that he... it's easy to forget this, given the way the weekend panned out. He actually crashed right at the start of Super Pole 2 as he was going out there in the filthy wet conditions of Saturday morning, where it was absolutely lashing it down. Jonathan Rea then picked the bike back up, didn't get back out there on track until about 4 minutes to go. So he only had two hot laps to actually get the job done. And immediately on his first time lap, he was a second ahead of I think Tom Sykes, who was on pole at that stage. And Sykes ended up qualifying third, a second and a half down. It was Leandro Mercado who actually took second on the grid between the factory Kawasaki's. We'll talk about him later on. As you say, Dre, Rea is meant to be, as we say, a leveller, as the cliche goes in World Superbikes, but it kind of had the opposite effect this time, because quite clearly, as well as being the best guy in the dry, Jonathan Rea is quite comfortably the best guy in the wet as well.
Yeah, we have come to the conclusion that World Superbikes is basically Moto3. Add rain, then a race gets infinitely worse. And surprisingly less competitive there. The rider seems to stand out a lot more, and Jonathan Rea completely destroyed everybody, and the rain spaced everybody out a little bit more. It was very bizarre in that sense. It led us to a bit of a dry spell in terms of a race itself, but still, it just highlighted just how much of an advantage Jonathan Rea had in those conditions. Fantastic stuff.
Yeah, we didn't really get much in the way of excitement until Malandri caught Sykes in the closing stages, and he had a brilliant battle on the last couple of laps between those two as they were fighting over second. We'll talk about that in a bit. But I remember back when Jonathan Rea was on the Honda in World Superbikes, and I remember often looking forward to wet races, thinking, oh, this gives Johnny Rea a chance. So it was, even back then, it was a case of, yeah, Rea's clearly the guy to look for in wet conditions, and now that he's the best in the dry as well, wet conditions basically render him a cheat code in those kind of conditions. He was so incredibly strong, and as I say it was so nice to see him win the championship in this fashion, wasn't it, given the way his two previous titles were won. And the outpouring immediately of congratulations towards him. And what really put a smile on my face, Dre, I don't know about you, was one of the very first people on social media to congratulate Jonathan Rea was Marc Márquez, the reigning MotoGP champion. And that just goes to, says it in many ways better than any of us can, when the best rider on the planet, Marc Márquez, even he rates, respects and appreciates Jonathan Rea as high as just about anybody, which just says everything.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a strong case of game recognized game here. Just saluting his amazing performance. Marc Márquez, the best bike rider on the planet right now, if you ask me, is giving a tip of the hat to the man on the superbike right now, which is very, very nice to see. Unbelievable. Unbelievable outpouring. So I saw Max Biaggi pull out and support Alex Lowe's, his old adversary and rival, but again, one of the first guys to congratulate him after the race. Guys from BSB was, and then obviously MotoGP themselves, and the Acrotis, they do keep half an eye on their own sister product, even if it's like little sister. But still, yeah, like the outpouring of support kind of said they'd all really need, like, they know this man's the best. And we salute him thusly.
Yeah, he's quite clearly the best. And yeah, it was cool to see so many people stepping up and voicing their congratulations to him. In terms of how he's won this championship, I mean, he's pretty much had it won from the get-go. He's been that much better than everyone else. And in many ways, Dre, the first four races didn't really tell us anything that we didn't already know from previous years about Jonathan Raikes. He won two tight races at Phillip Island against Chaz Davies, which, has, again, has been a sort of a feature of his previous two titles, where he's had some very close battles at Phillip Island, which have gone right the way to the flag, before dominating in Thailand, winning the two races there by an absolute mile. And it was really there where we saw Jonathan Raikes, one of the features of his season, which we saw in Thailand, where Jonathan Raikes was able to do what no one else really could do, and that's just slice his way from ninth on the grid to first in no time at all.
Exactly. That's been arguably the most important part of Jonathan Raikes' game, is in those race two. Him mastering the reverse grid rule is what's made him so strong. Like, the fact he's been able just to bully his way past the majority of the slower bikes in front of him in the first two or three laps, and he's able to comfortably lead and play. Something that Chaz and Tom has not really been able to do, his two main title rivals this season. I think that is what's stood out for me more than anything else, is that he's mastered and adapted to the new rules that's been laid out in front of him, and he's taken himself to another level again.
Yeah, he has. He's just... I said this last week about Jonathan Raikes, that when you throw rule changes at a sport to try and clip the wings of the best rider or best team in the field, you often find it's the best rider who finds a way around it first because he's the best.
Exactly.
And Jonathan Raikes has done that this year. So he took two wins in Thailand to take himself to four from four. That then became five from five at Aragon in race one. And then another key moment in the season, Dre, because I think Chaz Davies, we were still talking about him in terms of a real title push. But once Chaz Davies was beaten by Jonathan Raikes at the quintessential Chaz Davies circuit of Aragon, I think we all started to step up and realise that, hey, Johnny's just level above these guys.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, when he's able to go with Chaz and then beat him in race one, broke him in race one.
Forced him into an error where he fell off.
Yeah, exactly. Then was able to keep pace with him all through race two and, you know, was right there, right at the end of the race as well. It kind of proved that, yeah, Jonathan Raikes is just a cut above everybody else right now. He's found another part of his game where he can now match, if not beat, the best at their own circuits. I mean, we're going to talk about it in a minute as well, but Donington as well, where he was the first man to beat Tom Sykes' streak of consecutive, it was nine straight wins at Silverstone. At Donington Park until the race two rules came into play again. Tom was not able to get past the reverse grid runners as quickly as Jonathan did, and then by the time that Tom was in clear air, he ran out of laps. That kind of says it all, really.
Yeah, that's been such a key secret to Johnny Raikes' success. And yeah, you mentioned Donington, and as you say, he broke Tom Sykes' five-year winning streak, his nine-race winning streak at Donington. And again, it's another sign of what makes these riders so great, in that they, even when they're winning everything in sight, they still find new ways of motivating themselves to do even better. And I know from Greg Haynes mentioning it in commentary earlier in the season, that right the way back from November, from the Jerez test last season, when John and Ray outpaced a number of MotoGP bikes, it was a big source of motivation for him to basically sort of fill the blanks, if you like, from previous years. And beat Chaz Davies at Aragon was one of them, and beat Tom Sykes at Donington was another. Jonathan Raikes succeeding in both of those. And yeah, it's a measure of the man, isn't it? That even when he's won everything there is to win, essentially, in his class and in his sport, he's still able to find new ways to motivate himself and drive himself to even greater heights.
That's the part of Jonathan Raikes that, you know, we have to sit back and applaud. He never gets complacent. He's chasing history now. And again, this is his third straight title. He's not slowed down. He's still finding new ways to be fast and to be motivated and captivated. And again, like, the rules have changed. He's still found a way to come out on top, and he's showing no signs of slowing down. And he's in his prime now as a bike rider, and he looks completely invincible right now. I mean, he's only 31 in February. He's still got plenty of years yet where he can go out of his way to push harder and maybe break every record in the book. So Jonathan Rea is on a different planet right now to everybody else, and like no one's got any real sign to, at least in my opinion, of being able to challenge him at the moment.
No, I mean, Max Biaggi was still winning World Superbike titles at 40, wasn't he? So,
exactly.
Jonathan Rea, if he wants, could have another decade yet in World Superbikes if he still wants to compete that late into his life. But yeah, following on from Donington, where of course Jonathan Rea took what was Kawasaki's 100th World Superbike win there, beating Sykes for the first time anyone had beaten him there since 2012. We went on to Misano, and a key moment really in the season. I mean, even though we all pretty much assumed that even at that stage that Johnny Rea was probably going to win the championship, Chaz Davies and Tom Sykes were still close enough to have an argument to say they could still maybe make a late season charge if Johnny Rea had some problems. As it was, though, it was Chaz Davies that hit problems at Misano, and really the crash which took down Jonathan Rea. And in fact, it was the contacts from Jonathan Rea that ended up doing the damage, essentially ruling Chaz Davies. Even any slim hopes Chaz Davies had were extinguished at Misano, Dre.
Exactly. That was a disastrous round for everybody involved. You know, Sykes getting the jammy win was one thing, but obviously Chaz falling off there on the final lap at Misano, and Rea was able to continue, and, you know, Chaz got hurt, injured, missed time, and, you know, Jonathan was able to continue, still finish on the podium, still take, you know, massive points out of Chaz, and that effectively ended the title race as we knew it.
Yeah, it did. And Chaz Davies missed race two, which obviously cost him a whole heap of points, as Johnny Rea actually only finished third in that second race at Misano, as we had an unusual podium fight with Marco Melandri ending up winning that one in race two. On to Laguna Seca, where Chaz Davies returned from injury to win race one, but Johnny Rea then got his win back in race two, as Chaz couldn't find his way through the traffic this time as Jonathan Rea could. Lavsitz Ring, around that Chaz dominated last year and dominated again, but Johnny Rea did all he had to do really by finishing second to take a 70-point championship lead over Sykes, who was really now his only semi-realistic title contender. And then that all ended, Dre, in a ball of fire at Portimao.
Exactly, just a technical error again. The bike just died on Tom, caught fire. Of course, Tom's been flung off the thing. You know, pretty much broke his thumb in half, poor guy. And again, had to miss both rounds in Portimao at our weekend, which of course Jonathan Rea won both races in. Chaz Davies falling in race one as well was the last thing anybody would have wanted as well. Absolutely, you know, pretty much ending the slim chances that either of them had at the title at that point. That was pretty much all they wrote on that one.
Yeah, it was. And of course, Jonathan Rea would then go on to clinch the title last weekend at Magny-Cours. And, you know, the injuries to Davies back at Misano and to Sykes at Portimao really have, rather than deciding the championship, just more delayed the inevitable, or brought forward the inevitable to Magny-Cours, who probably won it at Jerez anyway, had that not happened. And it's worth pointing out that it's not like Jonathan Rea has had a season that hasn't had bad luck intercept it at various stages. Of course, he had the tyre coming off the rim at the bottom of Carena Curves at Donington, which ruled him out of a podium there. And hell, he's lucky he didn't rule him out of more. He's lucky he didn't hurt himself there, given how high speed a crash it was. And then, of course, he was tripped up by the Davies crash, which was no fault of Johnny Rea's. And that Misano, which left Jonathan Rea to pick his bike up off the floor and finish third as his teammate won the race. And it's amazing how this plays out, Dre, because, of course, in Magny-Cours at the weekend, much like in 2015, where Jonathan Rea won the title and then his bike failed on him in the final round in Qatar, once Jonathan Rea has the title won, it seems as if the racing gods decide they want to turn on him again.
Exactly. Look what happened in France race two. Eugene Laverty falls off the bike. And as the bike falls, obviously loose with no rider on it, it tags Jonathan Rea and it basically breaks his rear brake and suspension unit. So Jonathan had to immediately go into the garage and park the bike. I think he damaged his ankle a little bit as well. Hopefully not too bad. But nasty, unfortunate series of events there for Johnny on that one, where just completely caught by a falling Laverty and a loose bike. Very unfortunate in that sense.
Yeah, because we're talking again about Jonathan Rea trying to find new ways of motivating himself, and one of those was to try and set the new World Superbike all-time points record for a season, which is currently held by Colin Edwards after that thrilling 2002 season where he and Troy Bayliss won every race but one between them over the course of the season. Jonathan Rea now has 456 with 100 left to play. play for. So essentially, Dre, there is no other way of saying this. For Jonathan Rea to now break the record, he now has to win each of the last four races. The two in Jerez and the two in Qatar. Qatar, which in previous years has not been a Kawasaki round, let's be fair. If Jonathan Rea is going to win the championship. But even without that record, which looks like it might well just pass him by for another season, Jonathan Rea now surely... he's now up on a pedestal. We can ask the question in a minute whether he is already the greatest World Superbike rider of all time, but certainly he's now on a pedestal with Fogarty and Bayliss as the only three riders who can even make a case to being the greatest World Superbike rider ever.
Yeah, I completely agree. He's definitely in the conversation now as the greatest World Superbike rider we've ever seen. His complete dominance of a very stacked field, the combination of brilliant bike and rider. Jonathan Rea has taken himself to a whole another level now that he's moved away from Honda and has found himself on this Kawasaki and is spearheading his team. He's now the face of Kawasaki as a brand at this point. And it's no coincidence when you watch IndyCar races and you get Kawasaki adverts, Jonathan Rea is the guy in the adverts now. He is becoming the face of the series, the face of the brand for Kawasaki, and you know he's won these championships, and no one has even come close since he's joined Kawasaki. No one has been in the same ballpark as him since the start. And if he wins a couple more, and you know climbs that wins list a little bit further, he's definitely going to be in that conversation as the greatest we've ever seen in World Superbikes. He's incredible.
Yeah, a lot of credit deserves to go to Kawasaki on this one, who incidentally, Kawasaki Racing Team won the team's championship last weekend as well.
Of course.
By virtue of Tom Sykes's seventh place in race two, not the most glorious of ways to clinch a championship, but that was how they won it, with Sykes's 9 points for seventh in race two, because of course Johnny was out of that race. They deserve an awful lot of credit. And again, that you've mentioned there, the fact that Kawasaki are now using Jonathan Rea as a means to promote their machines around the world just justifies their decision to put all their eggs in the World Superbike basket.
Exactly. Like, who needs MotoGP right now? I mean, MotoGP is expensive. It's prototypes. It's an incredible amount of investment, and often the pain might not be worth it, especially now with more and more factories taking part, and it's hard to stand out in that sort of field. I mean, sometimes it is better off if you just drop down and dominate another class. And, you know, it's a more relatable series because these bikes you can actually go into a showroom and buy. 95% of what you get on a superbike you can buy in a dealership right now for the best part of 20 grand. So, yeah, like, when you've got a guy on this level, and, you know, Jonathan Rea is now won his 50th World Superbike race. He's only 9 off the all-time record now. And you've got that guy who's dominating World Superbikes, and he's on the face of every Kawasaki advert you see now, as opposed to Tom Sykes. Again, says it all. Like, the guy is unassailable at the moment. It's incredible.
Yeah, because when we're having this conversation about who is the greatest World Superbike rider ever, of course, Bayliss and Fogarty come into the argument, and you know Bayliss won his three titles, and as I say, it was very nearly four. He was beaten at the last corner by Edwards at Imola in 2002. Otherwise, he would have matched Fogarty for four titles. And yeah, Jonathan Rea has got all the time in the world, really, to go and match or beat Fogarty's record of four titles. And as I say, no one has ever won three in a row, as Jonathan Rea has done, obviously, that by association. No one has ever won four in a row, which Jonathan Rea will be looking to do next year. 9 race wins short of the all-time race wins record, which will probably go next year if Jonathan Rea keeps up his recent record of rate of victories. He's been double figures of victories in the last 3 years now. So that record could go next year too. He's been absolutely outstanding over the last 3 years. And as we say, Dre, Max Bianchi won World Superbike titles in his early 40s. We've got Shaky Byrne, who's still a class leader in BSB at the age of 41. There's no reason. If Jonathan Rea wants to, he could still have the best part of another decade at the top of World Superbikes.
That's a terrifying thought. Gosh, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, World Superbikes has been a bit more kind for the older rider out there, like people like Carlos Checa and Max Biaggi have still, you know, raced at an elite level deep into their late 30s and early 40s. So, again, there's no reason to suggest why Rea can't, you know, stick around for many, many years. around that. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see.
Yeah, and of course there are some who are saying, hey, he's still only 31. There's still time for him to make that MotoGP switch. Hey, as much as I would love to see that, because I think he deserves to be in that company. He is, you know, he is every bit as good as the majority of the riders in that field, in MotoGP. And like we said right at the top, when you've got people like Marc Marquez who are recognizing how good this guy is, that for me settles the argument that anybody would try to put forward about how good Jonathan Rea, or indeed how good the best of World Superbikes are. Jonathan Rea is a match for anyone in world motorcycle sport at the moment. His misfortune, if you want to put it that way, in race 2, opened the door for Chaz Davies to take victory in race 2. Chaz Davies, who'd done the double last year at Magny-Cours, in the two races, one of which was heavily affected by rain, as the first race was this weekend. Race 2 was briefly affected by rain, in that there were slight drops of rain falling as the race went on, and despite that, which at one point looked to threaten Chaz Davies' hopes of a victory, this was a race really from Chaz's point of view, Dre, that was just begging to be won.
It was, yeah. I mean, which way you cut it, I mean, race 1 was disappointing for Chaz because he was in the wrong engine map. He had the map for dry setup, and he kept switching between dry and wet, and that's what ultimately hurt him in that one. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Race 2 was a gimme, given that Jonathan Rea was not involved. Chaz has always gone well around Magny-Cours. But the second half of the season in general, Chaz is very strong. So, yeah, he had a golden chance to pick up a bit of form and get a win here, and he absolutely did it in convincing fashion. No one else really gave him a threat up the front. And, yeah, just a very, very clear, straightforward victory given, you know, the issues with Jonathan Rea.
Yeah, and it's amazing how this season, again, in another way, is following on from the last 2 years, because it looks like we're heading for another final round decider to see who finishes a runner-up, aren't we? Between Chaz Davies and Tom Sykes, who had a mixed weekend. Sykes, who we shouldn't forget, is still riding injured and having snapped his thumb at Portimao last time out, and was still in an element of discomfort last weekend. His performance in race 1, I think, was certainly more impressive than his race 2 showing, where he was anonymous, really selected the wrong tyre compound and ended up 7th. But his battle with Marco Melandri at the end of race 1, Dre, in a sport which has come in for criticism in recent weeks and recent rounds for how boring, in inverted commas, it's been, with Jonathan Rea dominating, that last couple of laps between Tom Sykes and Marco Melandri was some thrilling superbike racing.
Stunning stuff. Just ruthless from both men there. Block passes, you know, standing guys up, you name it, it was there. That was a magnificent last couple of lap dogfight between Melandri and Sykes there. Old school bike racing at its finest.
And they very nearly took each other off at Estoril as well. The fast right-hander at the start of the lap, where their different lines were very striking, where Sykes, who, as you mentioned himself, he was just struggling for grip, so he was trying to take the Tom Sykes line of, you know, making a V through a corner rather than the U shape, and really trying to sort of fire out the corners from a relatively slow apex speed. And of course, because he was taking much wider lines to try and fight out the corner, he ended up chopping across the front of Melandri, who was trying to go up the inside of him with a couple laps to go, and the two came together, and bits fell off the front of the Ducati as well as it happened, and, you know, somehow Marco Melandri didn't fall off the bike. And was able to get back on board and overtake him on the final lap to take second place. Sykes taking third, which with Davies down in 10th in that first race, gave Sykes a sizable advantage in the fight for the runner-up spot. But of course, he handed those points all straight back again to Davies in race 2 by finishing in 7th place. As it is at the moment, there are 9 points between them. Sykes over Davies for second in the championship with 4 races to go. So that one will probably go down to Qatar. In terms of race 2, though, with Davies taking the win and Jonathan Rea out of contention and Tom Sykes struggling, first time that Kawasaki, incidentally, have not had a podium finisher in a World Superbike race since the final round of 2015, the aforementioned race where Jonathan Rea's bike broke down. Every single race since then has had a Kawasaki rostrum man, until this one, because the two remaining rostrum spots alongside Chaz Davies were taken by Yamaha riders. And another piece of history, the first double Yamaha rostrum since the final round of 2011. In Portimao, back the last race before Yamaha pulled out of World Superbikes, way back when Marco Melandri and Eugene Laverty were their riders. And to be fair to Yamaha, whilst this result doesn't necessarily suggest that they've made progress, because of course the two main protagonists in green were having their own problems, it's a deserved result, isn't it, Dre, this for Yamaha, who've been there or thereabouts all season. They've been there to take advantage of of misfortune ahead of them, and that misfortune has never really come for Yamaha this season. But they got their awards this time, and a second and a third is just reward for the progress they've made this season.
Yeah, they've done a great job all season long, pretty much, and you know you can't argue with that. They've deserved something like this, something along those lines. Pretty much all season long, and again, as you say, they were always going to get something like this as a result of other teams, you know, having bad days. And again, that hasn't really happened this season. I mean, there's asking four bikes to, well, at least three out of the four to have a bad day is a big ask in bike racing. But they'll take those results where they can get them, and yeah, second and third, their best result of the year as a team was tremendous stuff. And yeah, well earned indeed for both Lowe's and Vandermark indeed.
Yeah, and they were just 3 seconds off the win with Alex Lowe's, and it was incredible, wasn't it? Because at one point, as the drizzle started to fall in that second race, and of course, World Superbikes does not have red flags in dry races. They have the bike changes, or the tyre changes, should I say, in pit lane. So we knew this race wasn't going to be stopped. And with a few laps to go, as the drizzle was starting to fall, many of us were watching this, including probably a very hungover Rebecca James down under somewhere. In Australia, I think we were all sitting there thinking, is Alex Lowe's going to win this one?
Yeah, like he was challenging. He had a good turn of pace out there. You know, had half an ask of, you know, maybe getting up there and, you know, really, really challenging for it. But not quite on this occasion. Chances of a little bit too much in hand.
Just needed that rain to get a little heavier, didn't he?
Indeed, he was right on the brink there. So unlucky, but a hell of an effort indeed.
Yeah, hell of an effort from the Yamahas. Second and third, their best result of the season, as I say. First double wash jump for a Yamaha World Superbike team since Portimao 2011. They got that double wash jump, and as much as we're happy to see that, we kind of wanted a rider wearing red leathers to be on the podium with them. And I'm not talking about Marco Melandri here. We're talking about a Briton on an MV Agusta. Leon Camier, who took fourth in race one. Stop me if you've heard this before. Leon Camier finishing fourth. It's happened a lot in recent years. Which earned him race two pole for the second race of the day. And given his pace, we all thought, certainly I did, much like in Portimao, thinking, well, this has surely got to be the one for Leon Camier to finally get that MV Agusta on a rostrum. But once again, Dre, just as everything looked good for MV to finally step on a rostrum, the bike went pop.
Here we go again, folks. An MV Agusta blows up in a critical moment again. Like it's stopped being funny now. It's getting ridiculous. Like, guys, come on. Like, the guy is riding your nuts off this machine right now. And like, when the thing blows up, it must be just utterly infuriating for Camier, because he's so good. And yet here we are again, just another case where he's performed strong, but unfortunately he's been had it ripped out from underneath him due to a result of poor reliability.
Yeah,
again.
And there are rumours circulating, or there have been rumours in the last month or so circulating, linking Leon Camier with the Red Bull Honda seat alongside Stefan Bradl next year, which took me by surprise when I first heard it, thinking, why would Camier want to lead the team he's at the moment? But with every MV blow-up that goes past, Leon Camier is going to be looking at that Red Bull Honda seat, and he's going to be looking more and more attractive to him, isn't it?
You have to think that. I mean, yeah, okay, Honda is a long way off where the MV is in terms of raw performance right now, but just the reliability alone would be worth it.
And later down the road, you think the ceiling is probably a bit higher at Honda than it's ever going to be at MV?
Yeah, I would say so. At least that's my opinion. I think Honda might be a better... I mean, it's a factory seat. It's only going to get better as time goes on and as more investment comes in. MV don't really care about World Superbikes right now, and it's not even really a factory team, quote-unquote. They're run by a third party, and yet MV themselves don't really pour money into the program. So Camier is basically riding essentially a dead horse. And it's come back to hurt them in the long run, really, and that's a shame.
Yeah, I mean, it's coming back to hurt them in the super sport class as well, isn't it? Given that, I mean, they had a podium this weekend with PJ Jacobson, which we'll cover in a moment, but that was the first podium for him and for MV Agusta's factory World Supersport team all year. They've been in a state of decline in super sport, and yeah, unless they pump some money into the superbike program, they're going to be declining there too. Yeah, there's talk of them moving to two bikes for next season, MV Agusta, but I think if they lose Leon Camier, it's almost pointless. It's like, would you rather have one outstanding rider or two bang average ones? on your bike? Which I think is the question that's going to be posed to MB at the moment, because it's all well and good putting, with the greatest of respect, a Jules Clouzel or someone of that ilk, or a PJ Jacobson on their bike next year. But are they really going to get the kind of results that Cammy is getting at the moment? Probably not. Because Cammy has got that level of experience in superbikes, and he knows that bike so well that if they can just throw a little bit of development at it and just, you know, turn that bike into a regular podium contender, allied to some reliability, which always helps, then they've got the right rider on the bike already. And I just fear they may be testing Leon's patience a bit too much at the moment, given that there are factory seats, particularly at Honda, still available for next year.
They're asking for it.
They're almost asking to be dropped. So let's hope that MV, if they're going to keep Cameo, they get their act together. One other rider then that we have to mention before we move on to the super sports is Leandro Ricciardo, who we mentioned earlier on, because Aprilia didn't have the greatest of weekends with their factory Milwaukee team. Eugene Laverty was sixth in race one, albeit a minute behind the dominant winner, Jonathan Rea, and then of course crashed and took out Jonathan Rea in race two, with Lorenzo Savadori breaking down from fifth on the final lap. Leandro Ricciardo took advantage of that to take sixth, which allied to his first ever front row start on the Saturday, all adds up to a pretty solid weekend.
Yeah, you can't complain there. You know, again, it's a solid top six finish. I mean, with the team that he's got around him, I mean, you're not expecting too much out of him, but again, really solid for what it's worth. Can't ask for any more than that. A very nice top six. And again, a great front row start as well. They're very brave in those conditions to go out there and really go for it and get on the front row. And the best of the rest outside of Johnny is an impressive job.
Yeah, I owe them. They're almost a bit of a subject of ridicule in World Superbikes and in motorcycle racing as a whole, given how piss poor their Moto 3 program was a few years ago. So they do tend to get mocked a little bit in motorcycle racing circles. So for Ricciardo to pull out the results that he's getting on that bike, with that team up against the factory, in inverted commas, a pretty team, which, you know, Ricciardo has beaten on more than one occasion this year, just shows what a good performance that he's putting in. Of course, it will go down very well in his home country of Argentina, which will be hosting a World Superbike round next year. The two race results then from World Superbikes. Race one was won by Jonathan Rea by just the 16 seconds from Melandri and Sykes, with Leon Cammia in fourth, Alex Lowe's fifth on the Yamaha, albeit he was 41 seconds off the winner, with Eugene Laverty a minute back in sixth, just ahead of Ricciardo in seventh. Davide Giuliano, his performance of eighth in race one deserves mentioning as well, on the Honda, ahead of Michael Vandermark and Chaz Davies. Vandermark went down on the first lap with Chevy Forrest, remounted, still finished ninth. Chaz Davies had those electrical problems which put him in the wrong engine mapping, and left him 10th, ahead of Salvadori, Ramos, Rafa de Rosa and Jordi Torres. The BMs hate the wet. And Ricardo Russo, who was 15th, took the final point. Chaz Davies won race two from the Yamahas of Lowe's and Vandermark, with Xavi Forres in fourth, ahead of Melandri fifth and Ricardo sixth. Tom Sykes only seventh, ahead of Torres, Ramos and de Rosa, with the Hondas of Giuliano and Jake Gagne 11th and 12th. Alessandro Andreozzi, Anthony West and Ayrton Badovini complete the point scorers. Jonathan Rea then is an unassailable 120 points clear of Tom Sykes, with just 100 left to race for in the championship. As I mentioned, Jonathan Rea's target now is 4 wins from the last 4 to set the new World Superbike points record. Tom Sykes' target is to hold on to second. He's 9 points ahead of Chaz Davies in that particular battle, with Marco Melandri a very lonely 4th on 281. That's 46 behind his teammate. Alex Lowe's is 11 points ahead of his teammate Michael Vandermark in the battle for 5th, with Chevy Forrest just behind them in 7th, Leon Cammia 8th, Jordi Torres 9th, and Eugene Laverty completes the top 10. Right, on to the Supersport classes, and we will start with the Supersport 600s, and a championship-defining weekend. Championship not decided in World Supersports, but a weekend, Dre, that unfortunately leaves a bit of a sour taste in the mouth in World Supersport. And a scenario where no one really wins. Least of all, Keenan Sofwoglu, who headed into this one as the championship leader, having overcome an injury-ravaged start to the season where he missed the first two rounds, returned in round three and was taken out of that one. So he didn't score a point until round four. Has won every race he's finished, really, this year in World Supersport, and arrives at Magny Cours and high-sides himself into oblivion, and the injury jinx has struck again.
Yeah, hip damage. They're saying that Keenan's going to be out for 3 months, which, you know, obviously means that he'll be out for the rest of the season. Which is
in three places.
Oh, the hip is an awful injury. One of the worst you can get as a bike racer. It's an awful, awful injury. There's no easy way of fixing a hip, no matter which way you slice it. It's essentially gift-wrapped the title to Lucas Mahias on this one, and it's a real shame. I mean, like I said on Twitter at the time, nobody wins in something like when these things happen. Keenan Sofoglu has, you know, he had you know, a challenge to basically reel in, you know, a Lucas from a free race disadvantage, given he was taken out in Aragon as well, and he missed the opening two rounds through injuries and testing. He'd clawed the gap back, had found a way to lead the championship again, and you know, this is a critical round going into Magny Court, and now he's injured himself again. And Mahias is basically going to win a title with an asterisk next to his name, because we all know Keenan is the king of super sports right now, and as a result, Keenan's basically going to miss the best part of half the season, and Lucas is going to win the title basically by default. And I feel really bad for Lucas, because he's talented, he's fast.
None of this is his fault.
Yeah, of course. He can only beat any put in front of you at the end of the day. And the problem is he's looked second rate compared to Keenan in terms of head-to-head competition. And, you know, he's won the races he can win for the most part. And, you know, as a result, now it's brutal as a result. And now, as it was, you know, Mahias wins a title you could argue he might not really deserve. And Keenan, who, you know, was faster than Lucas in the races he was healthy in, you know, has had no chance to win the title because of injury. So it's a lose-lose for everybody. Everybody loses, and it's just miserable for the fans.
It is. I totally agree with you. I feel sorry for Mahias. So, I mean, first of all, on Sofoglu, I mean, it was, as soon as that happened in Super Pole and we saw him just lying in the gravel, clearly in agony, I just thought, oh no, it's happened again. This was the scenario we were desperately trying to avoid. Look, like I said, none of this is Mahias' fault. And injuries have always been a part of motorcycle racing, so Mahias in no way should feel like his own achievement is being devalued here, because of course this is going to be the biggest achievement of his life, but unfortunately that is how it's going to be perceived as a result of this. And Mahias' weekend in itself had its own problems. I mean, he's riding injured as well, given that he had a crash earlier in the weekend, which left him with some pretty painful injuries. I mean, Mahias went into the race with a sore wrist and a sore ankle after crashes, but he had his own problems, Dre. I mean, throughout every dry session that we had, all of them seemed to indicate that the man to beat in the dry, the man with the pace, best pace out there, was Lucas Mahias. Probably in dry conditions going to win the race, but then he didn't get the chance to show how good he could be in a dry race because his bike failed in Super Pole, which left him 12th on the grid. And then because he was so low on the grid, he tripped over riders on the first lap and was 19th after lap one.
Exactly. He beat himself up out there, basically. He was riding hurt and then, basically, almost fell off the bike on the opening lap and had to claw his way back up to finish in the top five. Lucas really made a dog's dinner of this one, but did eventually get the job done. But I think it could have easily been a lot more if he had just been able to keep his head screwed on throughout the race rather than having to spend the first five or six laps getting through the midfield.
Yeah, it was almost like in that race, given how aggressive he was, it almost looked like he was trying to sort of, out of sympathy, hand it back to Keenan again by sort of hurting himself again, because he was so aggressive in that race. And, you know, in a vacuum, if you ignore what's happened to Sofoglu, that was, in many ways, I thought, a champion's ride from Mahias in that race, in that, you know, on that first lap, he was almost trying to go full Johnny Ray, given where he was on the grid. He was trying to slice his way through and get to the front, which involved nearly running up the back of Michael Canducci twice on that first lap. Canducci, who ironically is one of Keenan Sofoglu's two teammates, which was the irony of that Mahias nearly tripped over him twice on the first lap through no fault of Canducci's. It was just Mahias being aggressive. But to come from 19th on the end of lap one to fourth was an outstanding piece of riding. And as I say, in any time he had empty tarmac ahead of him, Mahias was the fastest man on track. But obviously with Keenan out of play and with Mahias so far down on the field, again, it's going to be perceived, Dre, as Mahias could only manage fourth and has taken the championship lead because Keenan wasn't out there.
Yeah, I mean, that's the best Lucas can hope for now. It's just, you know, just hopefully people forget about this and he just gets his head down and shows his class.
Yeah,
really.
I really hope he turns up at a ref next weekend and just goes out and wins the thing.
Yeah, that would be just the best case scenario, really, for everybody involved, because I'd rather have that than, you know, him limping to the title via mediocre performances. That's just going to reinforce the narrative that Keenan was better this year. I don't want that. So, again, I can only hope that they find, you know, that Lucas goes over there and balls it so we don't have this problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it, what we do have now is the potential for a rather bizarre championship scenario over the last two rounds. Just to set the scene, Mahias leads Sofoglu now by 9 points, which almost needs discounting because we won't see Sofoglu again this season. He actually leads Sheridan Marais, who's third in the championship, by 32 points, and he leads Jules Cluzel, who's fourth, by 39 points. Those are the only other riders who can catch Mahias in the championship. Now, if Lucas Mahias beats Sheridan Marais and Jules Cluzel on the road at Jerez next time out, he is essentially the champion because neither of those two can catch him. But here's what's daft about it is that if Lucas Mahias is not in the top two next time out at Jerez, mathematically, Sofoglu could still catch him, even though we're not going to see him again all season. Sofoglu would be within. If Mahias is third, for instance, at Jerez, he would be 25 points ahead of Sofoglu. But Sofoglu would have the tiebreak of having won more races this year. So in theory, if a one-legged man could turn up to the ass-kicking contest in Qatar at the end of the season and win the race, Sofoglu could still win the championship. But of course, that's not going to happen. So what I'm desperate, this is why I'm so desperate, Dre, for Mahias to go and win at Jerez. Because if he doesn't finish top two, he's essentially going to win the championship, but not mathematically win it. It's just going to be confusing for everybody.
Yeah, he can still be beaten by a guy that can't race. That's so stupid. I'm not here for this, yo. Just have Lucas win at Jerez and just end it, please. This does not need to be dragged on any longer than necessary.
Yeah, because we're all going to know that Lucas is the champion, but yet World Superbikes can't announce him as the champion because he mathematically isn't the champion. This is what we mean when we say that no one wins from this. Given what's happened to Keenan, because even Lucas, who's likely to win the championship and a tremendous achievement by anyone's standards to win a World Supersport title, we look at the riders that have won that in recent years, like Keenan, like Vandermark, like Sam Lowes, like Cal Crutchlow and Eugene Laverty, who've been premier riders in this class of racing. Mahias can join those names this year, and it's unless he can just go out there at Jerez and just smoke the field, it's going to be tainted, unfortunately. For better or for worse. We should mention as well, in amongst all the championship permutations, the man who won the race at Magny Cort from his first ever pole position, first ever victory for the Finn, Nicky Tuuli, who came on the scene this time last year in World Supersport with some podium finishes as a wild card, and we all thought, hang on, who's this Finnish kid? Had a podium in extraordinary circumstances at Thailand in the season and then went rather quiet, but a great result for Tuuli and for World Supersport. The fifth brand new winner in the class this year.
Exactly. That's it. That's awesome. That's a really impressive result. Nicky Tuuli, again, as you say, was super good as a wild card. Came in, immediately got podiums, had our eye on him as a talent, and it's starting to come through. I mean, again, more a couple of good rides this season, but first win. Obviously, major milestone, was in a great fight with Kara Kusulo pretty much the entire race, him and Marais for a good two-thirds of that one as well. So, yeah, really impressive stuff from Tuuli there. And hopefully the first of many, because that Yamaha can go some.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't perhaps the result in the end that the team were looking for. I think the wrong rider won in my respects for the Calio Racing News. Of course, they still had Sheridan Marais, who was in many ways a championship contender once Sofoglu, of course, was taken out of it. And you know, had Marais won that race, he would have suddenly been right with Mahias in the World Championship standings. But of course, given that he fell down the field to eighth in the end, he lost three spots on the final lap and fell down to eighth with Mahias up in fourth. Sheridan Marais, the South African, is pretty much out of contention now in the World Championship. But as I mentioned, the fifth brand new winner in this class this season, joining Robbie Rolfo, of course, won in Phillip Island, Kara Kusulo, who won in Thailand, Mahias, who of course won at Aragon, and Sheridan Marais, his teammate, who won the stopped race at the Lausitzring. So just it reinforces, Dre, how unpredictable this season has been. Either Keenan's won or someone brand new has won.
Exactly, it's nuts. again, the good to see the Colossus staying competitive for sure. It's great to see that, and again, hopefully, again, a good sign that, you know, the class is a bit more rounded. You know, apart from Keenan winning everything.
The championship then, as it looks, then. Well, first of all, the result from last time at Magny Court, first time winner in Niki Tuuli for Finland. Beating Federico Caracasulo, teammate to Mahias, of course, by 0.8 of a second. PJ Jacobson taking his first podium of the season on the MV Augusta. Remember how long ago it was when he was dominating preseason testing and looking like a championship threat? His first podium of the year in third, ahead of Mahias in fourth. Jules Clozel in fifth, ahead of Lorenzo Zanetti sixth. Michael Canducci, who is now essentially leading the Pichetti team, in 7th, ahead of Marias, Kyle Smith and Luke Stapleford in 10th place on the Triumph, with the rest of the points rounded out by Jakubo, Bergman, Sommer, who was the first of the ESS runners, Alex Baldellini and Christian Gamarino, who took the last point in 15th position. Championship standings then, as I mentioned a moment ago, Lucas Mayes leads Sofwoglu by 9 points, but to all intents and purposes, he has a 32-point lead over Sheridan Marias with 2 races to go. Jules Clozel is a further 7 points back in 4th. PJ Jacobson is now 5th ahead of Caracasulo in 6th. Tuuli is up to 7th after his win, with Kyle Smith dropping to 8th. Luke Stapleford is 9th on the Triumph, and Anthony West, who of course is now riding in the Superbike class, is in 10th place. Robbie Rolfo drops out of the top 10 now. Unfortunately, he's down to 11th, although he did return to the class last week as a replacement rider in one of the lower Honda teams in the class. So he is back on board a World Superbike machine, but unfortunately, he's down to 11th in the points. Now, finally, the Supersport 300 class, which I think, Dre, continues to come on leaps and bounds. Another thrilling race in the lightweight class this weekend, including an 8-rider fight for the victory.
As you do. Another bonkers Supersport 300 race. Again, like, it is watching basically Moto 3 half the time. Everybody's everywhere, four wides into hinges and hairpins. Everyone looking for alternative lines and trying to find a way around it. Crazy, crazy stuff. Great finish at the end. And a dab, because of course.
Another circuit, I think, which again just suits these bikes down to the ground, given how flowing it is. So many fast corners, so many opportunities, as you say, to take different lines, and so many opportunities to overtake. And it's become noticeable to me, as the season's gone on, how these two riders have distanced themselves from the field in the championship. And I don't know about you, Jay, but you can almost notice it in the race. The racecraft of Garcia and Coppola, the two championship frontrunners. Garcia, who just almost like the Lewis Salom tactic of Moto3 for a few years ago, with, you know, getting involved in a race in a multi-rider fight for the win, and then with a lap to go, just pulled the pin and dropped them. And Coppola showing his racecraft, dropping as low as, well, first of all, he had to come from 10th on the grid, and a number of times would drop back down into the group, but would still fight his way back to the front. And just showing these two with their racecraft, they've distanced themselves and they've shown themselves to be the class of the field this year.
Absolutely. Those two have been the standout names in this class this year. They have absolutely, they crush it right now. Like, they have the distinct way of getting to the front and staying there. And those two have been the standout names, I'd say, at least in the second half of the season. Maybe he had a bit of Scott DeRue at the start, but I think he's fallen off a little bit. But these guys have come to the forefront, and they're doing a great job.
Yeah, they have. And as Dre mentioned, he was very keen on the dab over the line from Mark Garcia. There was a bit of angriness to that dab as well. The way he did it over the line. And yeah, I mean, that's one way to celebrate a race victory, a key race victory as well, which has given him the lead in the championship. Garcia, the winner in that race, ahead of his main championship rival Alfonso Coppola in second place, which gives him a 4-point lead in the championship. The final podium spot was taken by the Dutchman Robert Schottmann, who is the teammate, incidentally, of Coppola in third place. Coppola, incidentally, has now earned himself a spot on the World Supersport grid next year with that, because there has been a inter-Yamaha battle this year called the Blue Crew Challenge amongst the officially Yamaha-supported riders, of which Coppola is the highest of them in the championship and has earned himself a European ride with the a Yamaha-backed team in Supersport next year, which means that he will basically be riding the European rounds of the World Supersport Championship next season. Which is a result of note, really, for Coppola. It means he's guaranteed a spot in a higher class next season. But as I mentioned, he was second in that race, ahead of his teammate Schottmann, with Mika Perez in fourth, Danny Valle fifth, and Paolo Gracia, who qualified on the front row, sixth. Borja Sanchez, seventh ahead of Facco. Scott Darroux, the early championship leader, ninth. He's now out of the running. With Enzo De La Vega, another of the officially backed Yamaha riders, in tenth. Shout out for one other rider who's nowhere to be seen in that result, and that's Alan Mule. Who's a rider that none of you, none of us, even me or Dre, would have ever heard of going into this weekend. But he was making his debut as a wild card in the Supersport 300 class. And because it was pissing it down with rain on Saturday, he went and put it on pole position, as you do, for his debut race in the World Championship. But he quickly got swallowed up on the first lap and then crashed halfway around it. So his dream quickly turned to a nightmare. But shout out for him for a cracking debut outing on the World Championship scene. Championship standings then, with one race to go. Garcia leads Coppola by 4 points. It's essentially a winner-takes-all battle between the two in the final round. Mika Perez is now out of the running in third. He's on 96 points ahead of Scott Duro on 91. They're both over a race win behind the top two, so cannot win the championship in the final round. Borja Sanchez is fifth ahead of Danny Valle, sixth. Robert Schottmann, seventh. Doran Lerero, the South African, is eighth. Anna Carrasco, winner last time out in Portimao, ninth. And Armando Pontoni, another of the Italians, in 10th. Yes, as I mentioned, final round for the World Supersport 300 is next time out at Jerez, because they don't go to Qatar, which means that it is a winner-take-all. Whoever wins the race out of Garcia and Coppola will win the championship. Garcia, though, does have the tiebreaker of having won more races this year. He's won two races to Coppola's one, which means that anything other than a win for Coppola means that he will have to be two spots clear of Garcia to win the championship. A second would not be enough with Garcia at third, because Garcia would win it on countback. So that is what is to come the next time out at Jerez. We'll also have the championship decided in Stock 1000 as well next time out. They don't go to Qatar either. And we'll have a three-way championship fight, because Jeremy Guarnoni, the former champion, won his home race ahead of Florian Marino and Federico Sandi, with the reigning champion Michael Ruben Rinaldi only finishing in 10th, missing a golden opportunity to win the championship, because completing a nightmare weekend for the Turks, Toprak Razgatioglu also missed the race through injury, much like his mentor Kenan Sofoglu, because he dislocated his shoulder in free practice. So Toprak missed the race as well, which looked like it was going to ruin his championship hopes. But with Rinaldi only finishing 10th, we now have a three-way title fight going into the final round, with Rinaldi on 128 points, Marino on 120, and Toprak and Razgatioglu on 114, 14 off the lead. And so the three of those will go to Jerez to dispute the Superstock 1000 Championship. Rinaldi on a Ducati, Marino on a Yamaha, and Toprak Razgatioglu on a Kawasaki. One of those three will become the Stock 1000 champion at Jerez next time out, the next round, which is in a couple of weeks' time. Right, now let's turn our attention to BSB and head to Assen for the penultimate round of the championship and the second of the three showdown rounds in this season's British Superbike Championship. Another weekend which proved, as every weekend that goes to Assen proves, that you can't have a bad race around Assen, really, because it was two thrilling British Superbike races. I mean, to be fair, Dre, that first race can make an argument to being the British Superbike race of the year.
That was an incredible weekend of racing. Race one in particular was stunning stuff. The leading group of five, and again, a five-way dogfight between five different teams, and you know, five of the best BSB riders out there right now. Fantastic fight, and again, great racing all the way through. It's hard to break free at Assen. We only got it right at the end when Haslam broke free at the end of race one, but just absolutely sensational stuff. A great, great race indeed.
Yeah, and what ended up maybe becoming a key factor, a key moment in the championship, and a key moment in race one, it didn't actually take place in race one. It took place 24 hours before that, because Dre, I think what may go down to be a pivotal moment in this championship was what happened in qualifying at Assen, where, amazingly, in the wet conditions of Saturday, only one showdown contender made it through to Q3. And crucially, that one man was Haslam.
Indeed, and that might have been the difference here, that Haslam was basically given an enormous head start with everybody else making mistakes in the changeable conditions qualifying session that we had the day before. Has him getting on the front row just behind Edison while, you know, major showdown rival Shaky Byrne crashed twice in Q2 to basically put himself at 16th on the grid. It was a disaster for Shaky, and everybody else seemed to see just couldn't get a lap together.
Yeah, because Shaky Byrne, to his immense credit, did make up the ground in race one and got himself into that leading group. But as you mentioned, Dre, it was kind of all too late. He managed to get himself up to the leading group, and then Haslam, by the time Shaky got there, just had a little bit left in the tank, didn't he, and was able to go again and break it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and yeah, it's like the time it all shook out in the end. Shaky had run out of time, and Haslam had gone because everybody else was infighting each other. So yeah, Haslam having the luxury of being able to run comfortably was certainly the difference maker in race one compared to Shaky, who had to set fastest laps and, you know, be more aggressive to chase on. Probably had no tire left by the time he got to the front.
Yeah, and it's immense credit to Haslam, and it just shows that it's another feature of the format, and that it's such a reset by the time we start this showdown and we started it all in part, because it's almost as if though that tricky summer never happened for Haslam. Of course, he had that long run of rounds where he didn't win a race from Alton Park all the way up to Cadwell when he finally won a race there. And it's almost as if that never happened now, because once the showdown started, he's been the absolute class of the field.
Yeah, absolutely. It's amazing that he's been able to basically just like I remember Haslam saying, right, that he wanted to reset before the showdown came, because he had a bad run of form going into it. He limped his way in. Had not looked particularly strong.
Didn't score a point at Silverstone.
Yeah, in three races there, did not score a point. So he felt like he had to reset for the showdown, and he has done that with incredible effect. He's finished all four races since on the podium, and had two wins to his name, and no one else is at that level of consistency since the showdown began. So Haslam's gone from a dire run of form to having one hand on the title.
Yeah, it's incredible. He has a 32-point lead heading into the final weekend of racing, because there are three races at Brands Hatch around the GP circuit next weekend. So it's not won yet, but he certainly has one hand on it. And in the end, key mistakes, I suppose, really made the difference, particularly for Shaky Byrne, Drake. Of course, he had the two crashes in qualifying, which left him with such an uphill task in race one, and then had himself in a winning position in race two, and then a key error down at turn one when Haslam came past him that really put paid to his chances in that race as well.
Absolutely. Again, like Haslam, we lost control. We went a little bit too hard in race two. He got up to the first corner. He was never going to make the apex. He was never going to make the corner. Went off wide, and then Shaky got collected in that a little bit, and he ran wide as well, and he dropped down to fifth, and he was out of it completely. Haslam was able to claw his way back up to third, and Shaky again was like just did not make the most of a bad situation there, and finished in fifth, and ended up losing more points in a race that he was looks like he was going to win for a second there.
Yeah, it's very unshaky, like, isn't it? Because I mean, obviously he's the reigning champion as it is anyway, but he's never really struck me as a mistakes guy. He's always the sort of guy you can always rely on to get the results in. And it's weird the way this showdown has panned out, where Shaky has made key errors.
Yeah, he has made critical errors at bad times, and that's what's ultimately cost him big. And yeah, every time he seems to have had, you know, take control of the championship again, something else comes up that's basically been another setback. And that'll be the story of Shaky's 2017 season, one where he was never able to be truly consistent throughout the season and ended up costing him big time.
Yeah, and again, it just again shows how the season just reset when the showdown rolls along. Because Shaky led it into the showdown once the points were reset. Shaky was the championship leader, and it's been error after error since then. Not all of them Shaky's errors, has to be said, because he had the anti-fog problem on his helmet in the first race at Alton Park, which cost him so dearly, which left him without really much of a chance in that one. Didn't really figure too highly in race two at Alton either, and then, as I say, a mistake in qualifying, which left him without much of a shot in race one at Assen, and then a key error down at turn one, which left him down in fifth in that second race, and it's dropped into third in the points. And Josh Brooks is now the nearest challenger to Leon Haslam. And to his credit, he was a key move right at the end of that second race, which saw him snatch second place in the end from Leon Haslam to take at least some points back from the JG Speedpit Kawasaki member. But I don't know about you. I just don't get the sense that Josh Brooks has a triple in him, but Brian Tatch, to really make that ground
up. I don't think so either. No, I don't think so either. I think Shakey and Brooks are probably going to be the two most comfortable guys going into Brands Hatch, given what we saw earlier in the season. But I think they're both equally very fast around there, and they could easily take wins off each other, which is good news for Haslam, because as long as one guy doesn't triple header up, I think Haslam should be okay.
Mm. And even if one of those two does triple next weekend, Brooks, the best Brooks can expect to get to is 6.55. On points, so that means Haslam needs a minimum of maximum of 43 points across three races, so three podiums, does it, for Haslam to win the championship, whatever Brooks or Byrne does next weekend. So it is most certainly in Leon Haslam's hands next weekend, and at the very most we are now down to three championship contenders at Brands Hatch next weekend, because unfortunately, Dre, without really having a bad weekend as such, Jake Dixon's hopes have now gone.
Yeah, Dixon just wasn't able to run with that leading group of five in races one and two. And again, it's a shame, really, that you know, this is the end of what still has been an incredible season for Jake Dixon by any measure. He's been sensational pretty much all season long. Just a shame that the bike wasn't quite there for Assen this time round. And, you know, he'll only get better in time, but he'll still, I think, sit at home thinking this was a tremendous season to make the showdown and could still finish, you know, maybe in the top four.
He could still finish his championship runner-up this season, Jake. He's 22 points behind Josh Brooks in second, 21 behind Byrne in third. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility. Jake Dixon could still end this season as the runner-up in the championship to Leon Haslam, which would be some achievement for him, not just for him as a 21-year-old rookie, essentially, but also for that team, which is an independent, privately run team in the British Superbike Championship, up against the big hitters of JG Speedfit and of BYZ Ducati, yeah. And McCam's Yamaha, these incredible teams that they're going up against and holding their own against this season. Peter Hickman and Jason O'Halloran also out of contention now. O'Halloran had his worst weekend of the season, really. 10th in race one, 13th in race two. That Honda not really working around Assen, which is a surprise given how much it's improved as the season has gone on. Peter Hickman, again, solid weekend, 7th and 6th for him, but in the context of the showdown, nowhere near enough. We'd be remiss, though, not to mention the man who lit up race two, the winner of race two, and a moment that Dre has been waiting for since this move was announced to Bennett Suzuki. Salman Gittoli, Dre, is a race winner again.
Dab. Yes. Ginters. Yes. This is glorious. It proved it was no fluke, really, in race one, even given he was in that leading group in that one and two, and only just missed out on a podium in that one.
Without the red flag, he might have won at Silverstone.
Exactly, as well. That was another one where, it's been no fluke seeing the Suzuki come through. I mean, Bradley Ray's uptick in form as well in the last three rounds. Suzuki, I mean, I heard talk from James Whitten that they've got a new swing arm in from the factory boys at Suzuki. So, it's no coincidence that Suzuki has found a little something here. And it's no coincidence that the Ginters and both Bradley Ray on those new 2017 bikes have found a way to get to the front and have looked very strong indeed.
Yeah, and Quintoli also mentioning the fact that he just felt much more comfortable around the sort of wider Grand Prix tracks of Silverstone and Assen, as opposed to the more traditional British circuits, if you like, of Cadwell Park and such like, which don't necessarily suit Sylvain's style as much. So, yeah, he's definitely finding himself more at home. And as you mentioned, Quintoli, who's come under a bit of criticism earlier in the season for not quite pulling his weight at Suzuki. As you mentioned, Bradley Ray has often been ahead of him in that team. But I guess this weekend just proved that as much as form is temporary, class is still permanent and there is still a world champion in there. And he rode like a world champion on Sunday to basically outmaneuver and outfight the likes of Haslam, Byrne, Ellison, and Brooks, who were basically knocking spots off each other in that second race. And it was Sylvain who made that crucial break with two to go.
Exactly. Found the extra bit of pace, got away in race two and never really looked back on this one. Yeah, it was excellent out there. Just tactically was on the nose, let everybody else fight each other, take the front and pull away, and you know, couldn't quite bear down the rest of the field in time once they realized, wait, he's getting away. And by that point it was already over.
Yeah, Gintoli, who as we mentioned on previous editions of this show, is likely to be heading back into the World Superbike paddock next year with the Pochetti team. That's not official yet, but it is likely to be announced very, very soon. It's been a good news weekend, though, for Suzuki, because another of their riders impressed last weekend. Dre mentioned him a moment ago. In that first race, and it was noticeable to me, Dre, in that first race, in that six-way fight up the front, that six-man group, we had Leon Haslam, who's won World Superbike races and is likely to be this year's British champion. Shaky Byrne, who is the most successful British Superbike rider ever. James Ellison, who's a MotoGP rider. Sylvain Gintoli, who's a world champion. Josh Brooks, who's a British champion. And racing with them and holding his own was 20-year-old Bradley Ray. And to be holding that kind of company in his debut season as a rookie at the age of 20 just again illustrates just how good this kid is and how good he's going to be.
Absolutely. I mean, he's a future star in this sport. He's the bike has come through. Bradley has shown his class. And again, right in there in the leading group again this time round. Had an outside chance of a podium. Couldn't quite hold it together in the end. But again, Suzuki's come a long way. Bradley is going from strength to strength. He could be one to watch for a potential showdown spot next year if Suzuki keep making forward progress. I think he's been very impressive.
Yeah, and what was noticeable from MCN this week is, of course, they were talking about the spots on next year's grid that are being filled, because we're going to mention one of them later on that's been filled at Tyco BMW for next year. But the team boss of the Suzuki squad, Stuart Hicken, has been very, very keen to point out that he has a contract with Bradley Ray, a two-year contract, which, of course, he's in the first year of at the moment, which means that Bradley Ray is locked in with that Suzuki team for next season. And I think he and the other teams up and down the paddock will be checking the small print of that contract very carefully to see if there's a way out of it.
Yes. The way it's going right now, they'll be using all the break clauses that are in there.
Yeah, he is all the rider of them in demand for the future, because he is going places in British Superbikes. One round to go then, three races to go at Brands Hatch, and here is how the championship will look heading in. First of all, let's give you the results from Assen. Haslam the winner in race one from Shaky Byrne and James Ellison. Sylvain Gintoli fourth ahead of Josh Brooks and Bradley Ray, with Pete Aikman seventh ahead of Jake Dixon, John Hopkins on the Moto Rapido, Ducati Panigale, and Jason O'Halloran on the first of the Hondas. Race two then went to Sylvain Gintoli ahead of Brooks and Haslam, with James Ellison fourth and Shaky Byrne fifth. Pete Aikman sixth, ahead of Jake Dixon, Christian Iden, Dan Linfoot, and Brad Ray in 10th position. The championship then is led by Haslam. He has a 32-point lead over Brooks, 33 over Byrne. It's between those three, really, for the championship at Brands next time out. Jake Dixon's fourth, 21 points behind Shaky Byrne in fourth, with Pete Aikman fifth and Jason O'Halloran sixth. Christian Iden leads the BSB Riders' Cup. He leads the chase for the paperweight by 2 points from James Ellison, Dre, who we should mention, Ellison, who may well earn himself that consolation prize of the Riders' Cup by virtue of just finally getting his and the team's act together late in the season and converting that immense pace into results. But it was noticeable really from last weekend at Brands how Ellison almost took it upon himself to play the role of showdown spoiler.
Yeah, he was trying to deny it on the podium, and I was like, James, you're fooling no one here, mate. Like, Shaky was laughing in the background when he was like, yeah, I try not to get involved in the fight, and I'm like, liar! Who are you trying to kid here, James? No, but you're absolutely right. I mean, we all know that the series likes to market potential showdown spoilers, guys that aren't in the title race but will still be competitive. And Ellison was probably the biggest name I had circled on the spoiler list, because if Ellison gets his head together and the bike's working well, he can win any given race on paper. And he was right in the mix again this time around, more than anyone else. He had a pretty bad weekend by his standards. Ellison was the guy this time around, and he was excellent out there in both races.
He was. An excellent weekend for him, a third and a fourth for him. And to round off on BSB, I mean, yeah, we're not going to review the season just yet, because we've still got a round to go, but another season where British Superbikes has just shown how open and how competitive it is, because we shouldn't ignore the fact that Sylvain Gintoli, with his victory, became, count them up, the 10th different winner in British Superbikes this season. 10 different winners!
10. It's bonkers. You know, guys, it's easy to forget we've had guys like Glenn Irwin win races as well this season. He's been very, very good pretty much all season long. And again, it's just great to see the series continue to be competitive. He's doing a fantastic job. Right now, everyone out here is looking impressive. There's 8 or 9 guys that can win any given Grand Prix on paper right now. It's fantastic for the series and a great advert going forward at how open it is right now. And that is when the showdown format works.
Yeah, Leon Haslam, Josh Brooks, Shaky Byrne, Jake Dixon, Peter Hickman, James Ellison, Luke Mossy, Dan Linfoot, Glenn Irwin, and Sylvain Guittoli. Your 10 winners from the season. And that ignores the riders who've had podiums, like showdown contender Jason O'Halloran, like Christian Eden, who've had podium positions this season and could have won races if circumstances had gone their way. It's been a brilliant British Superbike season, and we have just one round to go. The three races, the triple header, the championship finale around the GP circuit of Brands Hatch in a week's time. Right, on to the news before we go. And Christian Eden is staying put for next season. We mentioned the British Superbike grid for 2018 is taking shape. And Christian Eden will be staying with the Tyco BMW team for 2018. And no question in our minds, Dre, that Christian Eden deserves that extension, because this is another rider, much like Luke Mossy, who we discussed last week, will feel he has unfinished business next season. He will feel he perhaps would have been in the showdown had injury not struck.
Yeah, I think the breakout season that no one's talked about has been Eden this year. And I think he would have made the showdown if it wasn't for injury this year. He's been great on that BMW, a consistent top five runner pretty much all year long. And I'm glad that Tyco BMW was rewarded him with another contract, because I think he's been more than deserving of that. He's been excellent this season, and I look forward to seeing him next year, where if he can take another step and maybe think about challenging for wins and getting into that showdown.
Well, Super Sport news for you, and two pieces of news. One that we didn't have a chance to fit into the running order, but news that did break in recent days. Kyle Ride, unfortunately, has left the Kawasaki Puccetti team for the remaining two rounds of the season. Of course, the team that has just lost Keenan Sofwoglu for injury for the rest of the year also lost Kyle Ride. Kyle Ride, whose fortunes really took a nosedive once Sofwoglu returned. Funny how that works out. Once the focus diverted back to their lead rider, Kyle Ride suddenly dropped back down the field, but he will not be riding for that team for the rest of the season. Of course, Kyle Ride, who is managed by the World Superbike champion, Jonathan Ray, so hopefully he can find him a ride on the grid for next season, because he did show in the early rounds of the season just what he is capable of in this class. The other piece of news surrounds Jules Clouzel, and he's on the move for next season, joining a new team that is based out in the United Arab Emirates, a team that has a brilliant name for next season. If only we need Gallows and Anderson to announce the team, because Dre Clouzel is joining the, say it with me, Nerds!
Yeah, I got the Homer Simpson line from when he goes back to college here. He just fixes his head and goes, Nerds! Racing team. It's a fantastic name, and I hope Clouzel wins the title now.
Yeah. If a team wins championships on team names alone, then that is it. The Nerds Racing Team, we'll tell you a bit about them, that Clouzel's going to join. I mean, Clouzel, for instance, is a great pick for a new team in the World Supersport Championship. Of course, he is a former runner-up in the championship. Based in the United Arab Emirates, as I mentioned, Clouzel will be joining that team. And they are going to be running, it doesn't actually say in this which bikes they're going to be running yet. So that will be interesting to see whether they run Kawasaki's, which of course are the class leader this year, whether they perhaps pick up a Yamaha that Mahias has been running with great success, or whether Clouzel, who is familiar with MV Agustas, even though he's ridden a Honda this year, he spent most of his career on an MV Agusta in World Supersport. Which bike the Nerds Racing Team run for next season? But their team boss, Vafi Khan, has gone out on record to say that their aim is to win the championship next season with Clouzel. And I'll put it this way, if you're signing a rider like Clouzel, surely your aim is the championship, because he is a championship-level rider in that class. We'll follow them with interest next season. The Supersport grid is taking shape, of course, because last week we announced that Mahias and Caracasulo are staying with the GRT Yamaha team, and of course Sofwoglu is staying with Kawasaki Puccetti, and will have unfinished business on his mind next year, given the injuries that have affected his 2017 challenge. World Superbike news: this doesn't affect World Supersports, because they don't go to this venue, but World Superbikes will be going to Laguna Seca next year, because they have announced a contract extension for 2018. Which is important, because as you mentioned earlier on, Dre, of course, Kawasaki are running adverts in America with Jonathan Ray on the front of them. So they kind of knew the United States round, even if in recent years, Laguna Seca perhaps has lost a bit of its magic as the round it used to be, because how's the best way of saying this? Recent rounds in Laguna Seca haven't been stellar.
Yeah, it was last year's was what was the straw that broke the camel's back, and people saying, why is World so boring, even though, you know, I don't think it had been boring to that point. I think people had just expected Laguna Seca to be class. It wasn't, and then they decided to shit on the series from a great height.
Because Laguna's not an overtaking track.
Yes, because Laguna Seca has never been a passing circuit, and it never will be. But, you know, narrative. But yeah, I'm happy Laguna is back. It's a good circuit. It's a good marquee sort of track to have on a calendar. It's good for Kawasaki as well, as I mentioned. They are very hard to break the American market. So it's good for the series in that sense. Not the most captivating round in the world to watch, but I hope 2018 bucks the trend a little bit.
Yeah, fingers crossed. I mean, what's going to be slightly sad, of course, is that as it stands at the moment, there won't be an American on the grid for the World Superbike round in America next year. Let's hope that changes between now and next July, when we expect that round to take place. Kawasaki, incidentally, have this week launched their 2018 ZX-10RR machine, which looks pornographic from the images on the World Superbike website.
Not safe for work.
Nope. So, yeah, head to worldsuperbike.com if you want to watch that. I want to see images of it. It is a beautiful piece of machinery, which will be running next year. News surrounding their competitors, though. Ducati, who have announced a piece of news this week which really shocked the world of World Superbikes. The news that Ernesto Marinelli, their Superbike project leader, is leaving the team. Dre, Ernesto Marinelli has been the project leader of the Ducati Superbike operation since 1995. This is a guy who has overseen some of the golden years for Ducati and Superbikes, including Neil Hodgson's title, James Toseland's title, Troy Bayliss's two titles on Ducati in 2006 and 2008, and Carlos Checa in 2011, all won titles with Ernesto Marinelli at the helm of this team. It's kind of an end of an era for this team.
It is the end of an era for that team. He's been part of Ducati for 25 years, a generation of time as Ducati Superbike leader, and, you know, an iconic name, an iconic part of the brand, and he's moving on to pastures new. So that's good. That's a real shame for the series, a real shame for Ducati, who, you know, has been spearheaded through him in recent times.
Yeah, it will be. And a new era for Ducati in many ways. Of course, they'll be moving to the V4 in future as well. A departure from their bike at the moment. So, time is changing at Ducati. And it was noticeable that they sent Ernesto Marinelli up on the podium at Magna Carta to accept the team's award for winning race two as almost a sort of a parting gift to Marinelli for his 22 years of service to that factory, which is coming to an end at the end of this year. News surrounding Moto3, and Makar Yurchenko is going to be a new name onto the grid, and a new nationality, the first Kazakh rider into the Grand Prix World Championship next season. Makar Yurchenko, who's impressed in the CEV this year, he won a race earlier in the year back at Albacete right at the start of the season. He will be joining the CIP team for 2018, which has been running Mahindras with the two Italians, Pagliani and Bezzecchi this season. They will be running KTMs next year with Machenko on board. So keep an eye on him next season. He's a new name to look out for. More news, though, surrounding the next MotoGP round, which, of course, is a week from now at Motegi, the first of the three Asia-Pacific rounds of the season. And a rider who will not be there because when Valentino Rossi injured himself a couple of, about a month ago and then returned with such success at Aragon, Cal Crutchlow famously said that it's going to lead to a trend of riders breaking their legs and then coming back as a faster rider. And Dre, it seems that Cal's best mate, Jack Miller, was listening.
Jack, what are you doing? That was not a good idea. you're absolutely right. I don't think that was a clever idea, Jack. Another low-speed enduro bike accident. Whoops, to say the least. A shame for Jack. Again, he's probably going to miss his home round as a result of this now. And, you know, the Australians turn out in force for Valentino and for Jack Miller, which is a real shame for them. And, again, wish Jack a speedy recovery. Yeah, no pressure, mate. Be back in 3 weeks.
Yeah, he's going to need Valentino's powers of recovery, isn't he, to be back for his home round at Phillip Island. Someone will be searching for Mike Jones's phone number again. And bring him back out for another wild card appearance at Phillip Island if he's not fit. In the meantime, Struglissi might be the SNIDA hero, and they found one, Hiroshi Oyama, who's going to replace Jack Miller at the Mark VDS team for what will be his home Grand Prix, of course, the Honda test rider at Motegi next time out. And unfortunately, Dre, that's a week away from now, which presents us with an obvious problem for next week, which we don't have a solution to at the moment. There is an awful lot to talk about on next week's show. The Speedway GP are in action this weekend. Jason Doyle set to clinch the title. Of course, with Rebecca James in Australia at the moment, we won't have her to tell you all about that. We will tell you what happened, but of course, Dre and I will struggle to fill 2 hours discussing it. And the CEV are in action this weekend, where Dennis Foggia can clinch the Moto3 Junior World Championship if he finishes on the podium this weekend at Motorland Aragon. He can clinch that championship with 2 races to spare. He currently has a 62-point lead in the championship over his nearest rival. But yeah, Dre, we're coming into that stage of the season where it's going to get very, very busy. Of course, we have the Brands Tripleheader in BSB, the 3 MotoGP races in consecutive weekends. And of course, the World Superbikes have 2 rounds still to go. But yeah, next weekend, we may be time-filling.
Yeah, like, good luck with that one, Lewis. I might pull a sickie for the week. I have to wait and see how we go. But yeah, I mean, this is the sort of time where it gets very stacked quite quickly, unfortunately. And as a result, you can get some situations where you get dead weeks like this one. That's one of the ones that's coming up next time around. So maybe we'll beat our heads together and figure something out.
Yeah, we'll bang our heads together. We'll come up with something. We went unscripted last time and still managed to fill 2 hours. So we'll come up with some sort of backup plan for next week. We'll no doubt have a show, episode 34. But watch this space in terms of what's going to be on it, because we don't know yet. but in terms of other things that you can follow on this network, episode 107 of Motorsport 101 coming up this week. And circumstances over the next 24 hours will dictate Dre's mood for it.
Just a little bit. Dive bomb into turn one. Yeah. No, sorry. Sebastian, you know the drill.
Yeah, because dive bombs into turn one at Suzuka have got a great rate of success, haven't they?
Listen, it's all I've got at this point, Lewis. Desperate times call for desperate measures. But we'll 107 of Motorsport 101 next week. Inevitably talking about all the news from Suzuka. Obviously more about the Jody and Palmer, Carlos Sainz switcheroo. That was breaking news about 20 minutes before we actually started recording this episode, because, of course, that and inevitably a whole lot more. Again, the Petit Le Mans, the 10-hour endurance race there from Road Atlanta with Team Penske at the front, and all sorts of other stuff as well. I'm probably digging into your mailbag as well. So keep an eye out for all of that stuff as well. But yeah, episode 107 next week.
Yeah, that's all to come next week here on Motorsport 101. In the meantime, you can follow us in all the usual places, facebook.com/motorsport101. On Twitter, we are at motorsport_101. Our YouTube channel is youtube.com/motorsport101. And indeed, if you want to back us financially on Patreon and earn yourself early access to Bike Live and Motorsport 101's podcasts, it's patreon.com/motorsport101. All the information can be found on our website, which is motorsport101.net. My thanks to Andre Harrison for joining me this week for episode 33, and I look forward to all of your company next week for episode 34, in a week where we salute the 3-time World Superbike champion, the 3-peat for Jonathan Rea. We will talk to you all next week.